All right, in this talk, I'm going to be speaking to every person here and every person who is listening on the CDs, laymen and laywomen, as well as priests and religious. I will point out, though, issues which are particularly relevant to priests. And I want to also, I will not mention his name for certain reasons that I can't tell you about, but I want to thank a priest friend of mine who was a student of my father's when he was in the seminary 35 years ago, who has synthesized many of these ideas for me and who has helped me to grow in my own understanding of St. Thomas and his anthropology and how to apply it in therapy. He is a holy man, and again, for reasons which I can't tell you his name, but I want to give him credit. So the subject of affective maturity holds a special relevance not only to every person and to society in general, but particularly to the formation of seminarians for the life of the priest and for the priesthood itself. Moreover, the anthropology of St. Thomas Aquinas, specifically his conception of the integral role of the passions for the life of virtue, demonstrates the psychic integration necessary for the mature development of the human person as well as for his or her personal happiness. This is particularly important for those of you studying for priesthood who, in addition to the sacramental duties of your priesthood, will become a spiritual father to many persons. So one important goal of this talk this morning is to give you a foundation to develop your own affectivity, and I will be defining that, to pay attention to the interior movements of your heart within the framework of reason and spiritual direction. The authentic anthropology of St. Thomas Aquinas was largely ignored for centuries due to a mistaken prejudice against the emotions as wounded by sin and leading people into sin. However, the passions are not the only parts of our nature wounded by the disordering effects of sin. The intellect and will are weakened as well. The doctrine developed by Anna Tarua and Conrad Bars revived and further developed St. Thomas's treatise on human nature, explaining the relation of the emotions to our intellect and free will. Using St. Thomas's distinction between what he called the concupiscible and irascible passions, they were able to identify two different kinds of emotional illness, which I've just talked to you about briefly: deprivation and repression. Dr. Tarua discovered the syndrome of deprivation neurosis, or emotional deprivation disorder, in which she postulated that a deprivation of love could generate a neurosis, such that these persons lack the capacity to forge normal emotional attachments with other adults or to feel secure or worthwhile. And together, she and my father showed that healing of this deprivation comes over time through the genuine affirmation of another person. As I've already discussed, many people of our time suffer from the syndrome of emotional deprivation or are at least unaffirmed to some degree. People who are narcissistic and selfish are so not just because parents and teachers exaggerated the self-esteem attitude, but more so because these very children never received the authentic affirmation they needed to feel lovable and secure. Their parents may either not have been present, or perhaps on the other extreme, they smothered them with many things rather than with their own affection. The priest, or any person, but the priest who is aware of the emotional wounds of his parishioners will be better able to preach, teach, and hear confessions with compassion. Although your duty as priest will not be primarily to affirm these people emotionally, as it will be true for others of us lay people. You must be able to understand how these emotional disorders weaken their moral life and their capacity for joy within the spiritual life. Your call will be to give spiritual affirmation through conveying the truth and sound moral guidance. However, for this to be fruitful, your parishioners will need to feel beforehand that you are their loving spiritual father. St. Thomas Aquinas said, "A passion of the soul increases the goodness of an action." Glenn, in his book, A Tour of the Summa, says, "A good act, performed with feeling as well as with intention, is all the better for thus coming more completely from the whole man." The Catechism of the Catholic Church says, "The human person is ordered to beatitude by his deliberate acts. The passions or feelings he experiences can dispose him to it and contribute to it. Taken together, one may conclude that to develop the capacity to experience and respond to feelings and emotions is crucial for the integration of every person. As the passions even participate in and can assist in the development of the habits of virtue." Now here's an example. St. Thomas judges the moral character of a person not only by what he or she does not do, but by the fact that he or she finds pleasure or joy in the good, or you might say also the evil, that he does. I'm going to give you some examples. He stated that virtue is not only in the will and reason, but it is also in the emotions. That might be a new one, huh? Right. So some exemplars of this, whoops, I think I'm one ahead. Yeah, there we go, sorry. Would be St. John Paul II and Blessed Teresa of Calcutta. What we saw in their faces, if you knew them and watched them on TV, was their delight in the people that they met. Their feelings were evident in their countenance, and they were open to others, to each person that they met personally, and this was an integral part of their gift of self. Remember, John Paul talks about the gift of self. And other people, and we watching, were delighted by them and attracted by them, and their joy often moved other people to love them in return. Now, Pope Francis is another excellent example of giving the gift of self, even as he witnesses to Christ. Countless people have been touched by Pope Francis's warmth and his open approach. And these two slides, if you want to just go back one slide, this is, I don't know if you've heard about this, Pope Francis met a man that doesn't have a face. And you see the Pope's look into this man's eyes, right? And the warmth and the invitation there. And then in the next slide, we see how he embraces him. And look at how Pope Francis is so, he's so present to this man with love. And in that, he gives him his dignity. Okay, so these are good examples. When we take St. Thomas's thought on how the passions participate in virtue, they also can participate in vice, right? They can be taken up into something that's evil. For example, someone who commits a very heinous crime and takes pleasure in hurting the other person. I thought, well, there wasn't any need for a slide here. There's plenty of examples you can think of and you've probably even seen on TV, right? But not only is this an evil act in itself, but it evokes a corresponding sense of repugnance in us and a revulsion towards that. So our own emotional reactions mirror what we sense about that person and their actions. So what St. Thomas refers to is not merely a judgment of behavior, but it regards the desires of the person and his object as indicative of either a virtuous or a vicious nature. So obviously, I'm not talking about a person can't be redeemed from acting in a vicious way. And the Catechism further quotes St. Thomas's thought on this matter. Oh, here we have some other examples of Francis. This one, I think you remember, there was a general audience, and this little boy cut loose, and he was just wandering around up there on the dais with Pope Francis, and he just took him under his hand and just kept talking. It's so sweet. Okay. So we'll go to the next slide. Thank you. And St. Thomas says, moral perfection consists in man's being moved to the good, not by his will alone, but also by his sensitive appetite. A sensitive appetite are the passions, the emotions. As in the words of the psalm, my heart and flesh sing for joy to the living God, whereby, by heart, we are to understand the intellectual appetite, and by flesh, the sensitive appetite. All of this is underscored by St. Thomas's central thesis that it is the nature of the passions to be guided by reason. So there's an orderliness to the psyche. So you might say, well, what does this have to do with me, right? So when over time we cultivate, we educate, and we refine our feelings for what is good, first on the natural level, hopefully as children we were permitted to explore in a safe structure, and then when we get older on the spiritual level, there is, in my father's words, a growing harmony and integration that ensues, and the emotions learn to follow reason ever more readily as they are meant to do. They develop an habitual disposition to listen to their master's voice readily and effortlessly. Furthermore, the cultivation of the emotional life, its entirety, not its extinction or repression, is a prerequisite for harmony, integration, and cooperation between reason and the emotions. Okay? We don't want to set up where reason is tyrannical or it fights the emotions all the time. This is what we call psychic disorder, right? Oftentimes it is repression. The emotions with their psychomotor reactions, and that simply means the physiological changes that happen within our body every time we have an emotion, exist in order to be integrated by reason and to move man under its guidance towards the happiness for which God has created him. In fact, this is what we call affective maturity, the integration of the intellect, the will, and the emotions. So, and here's a key idea. It is not by willpower alone that we are to live. Rather, St. Thomas is saying the emotions support and strengthen the will in its choice of the good when their power for affectivity has been developed. For example, you think about it, when you have developed the desire for something good, it is much easier to do. You can think of working out, dieting, studying, maybe going, you know, for lay people in particular, making a decision to go to Mass every day, right, and getting up early to do it, or just any time. It's like we have to develop that. But then eventually what we hope happens is that we desire it. Sometimes you might find it's like, oh, I miss it. I missed working out, or I missed going to Mass, right? It's like, because the desire now is helping to pull us towards it. It's easier to do. So the development of the emotions of the concupiscible appetite, which one could also call the pleasure emotions, because they have to do with what we experience as pleasurable or displeasing, enable us not only to love what is good, you see these are opposites, right, going across, and then there's a progression from love, liking, and to desire and joy, okay, and the same with this side. But these emotions enable us not only to love what is good, but to hate what is evil, not only to desire the good, but to have an aversion for the bad, for what is evil, to rejoice in the attainment of what is loved and desired, as well as to feel sad when what we hate and we want to avoid becomes unavoidable. So when the power for affectivity, which we might define as the capacity to experience love, desire, and joy, okay, it's this capacity. It doesn't mean that everything we're exposed to that is good, even the Holy Eucharist, is going to evoke those feelings, but we want to have the capacity for that. When that capacity is developed, we are capable of empathizing with others who experience things like difficulty, loss, and death, especially for the priest, right? While we are able to offer them hope and eternal life. In fact, to spiritualize the reality of pain and suffering is to minimize it and to deny others our affirmation of their experience of life right now. And you may have experienced this yourself. I've experienced it. When someone, you told someone how you felt and you were suffering or you were despondent about something or you thought, well, this can't happen or I can't do it. And the person immediately ignored your suffering and went right to the spiritual answer. And it may not have been the wrong answer, but it was given prematurely. And how did you feel? You felt not listened to, you felt not understood, and you felt not loved, and probably you remained closed to the truth, right? So St. Thomas says, when he says that the passions add to virtue or to vice, it is clear that the passions can cause us great pain and discomfort, which actually isn't, I'll talk about this this afternoon, it's not necessarily a bad thing when we feel discomfort and pain, but when it does this, the emotions vitally assist us to do what we must, either because we have been moved by something, just because we find it good or we find it evil and we don't like it, or because our assertive drive, next slide, has been aroused so that we have the hope and fortitude to overcome the difficulty that we face. This capacity proves to be a blessing when it's fully developed through the practice of being open with our feelings and emotions, as well as with your intellect, to all that is good, true, and beautiful. So this is this capacity for affectivity. And I'm gonna give you, I wanna show you a picture. This is this man's name, he's from Italy. His name is Vinicio Riva. And Vinicio Riva has a non-infectious genetic disease called neurofibromatosis type 1. And it's non-infectious, but it has left him completely covered with sores, and they ooze. His mother died from this illness, and his sister has a milder form of it. And his aunt, Caterina Lotto, says his undershirt is often completely soaked in blood that seeps from the sores. And what happens in his life is that when he rides the bus, oftentimes he's getting ready to sit down and people will say to him, get away from me, don't sit here. And so he said, it's very hurtful and I get really angry, but I don't say anything. Well, in early November last year, Vinicio traveled with his aunt and others from northern Italy to the Vatican City, where they went to a morning public audience held by Pope Francis. He has difficulty staying on his feet. I think he probably has these sores everywhere, so he was in a wheelchair. And so they said, his aunt said, we didn't think we would be so close to the Pope, but the Swiss guard kept ushering us forward until we were in a corner in the front row. And when he came close to us, I thought he would give me his hand. Instead, he went straight to Vinicio and embraced him tightly. I thought he wouldn't give him back to me. He held him so tightly. We did not speak. We said nothing. But he looked at me as if he were digging deep inside, a beautiful look I would never have expected. It was interesting. Vinicio, accustomed to stares of shock and fear, was initially confused by the pontiff's lack of hesitation. He didn't have any fear of my illness. He embraced me without speaking. I quivered. I felt a great warmth. The entire encounter lasted a little over a minute, and soon Vinicio and his aunt were back on the bus, Vinicio in a state of combined shock and joy. And his aunt said he was almost not himself. He was shaking. And Vinicio said, "I felt like I was returning home 10 years younger, as if a load had been lifted." So his life went back to normal. He went back to his job at a home for the elderly, collecting and throwing out trash, running odd jobs. He works there on weekdays. And in slower moments, he enjoys chatting with the residents who don't seem to notice his condition. His preferred topic of conversation is the ups and downs of Juventus, his favorite football team. So anyway, after these pictures became public, I think it was CNN where I found this, these pictures and this story, the media sought him out. And so his family was a little reticent because they thought, well, maybe this isn't a good thing for Vinicio to be interviewed. But they finally, he said, "No, I want to do this. I feel ready to do it." And so he said the encounter with Francis had emboldened him. And this is what I want you to hear about the power of affirming presence. He said, Vinicio said, "A change came over me. I feel stronger and happier. I feel I can move ahead because the Lord is protecting me." It changed this man and strengthened him to be himself. He's no longer defined by his illness and by how other people treat him. So the power for effectivity, our capacity for affectivity helps us to be open to others. And when affectivity is drawn by the highest good, we can willingly and better, at times gladly, restrain the expression of our love for another person. Here we restrain ourselves from doing what we want for the sake of the good of the other. So we love the good and we love the other person. And again, this is very different than just wanting to help someone, right? Because you can help someone mechanically. You can go to a soup kitchen and dole out the food and know you're doing something good and not be present to the other people and not be kind, go out of yourself. So when we do that, those actions are characterized only by effectivity, which is our readiness to think and act effectively and to achieve or produce something. And those things, that is not bad, but effectivity is designed to serve our affectivity. Or we might say action or doing is designed to serve our being, who we are. As human beings made in the image and likeness of God, right? And another way to say it is that our mind, our reasoning mind, should be operating in the service of our heart, right? And that's really how Jesus lived. So in order to be present to others, we need to guard our capacity to be affected, and therefore we need to guard our desires and our loves. When our desires become too attached to too many things, or they become disordered, we have less capacity and less attention to experience the goodness of other people, of the beauty and truth and goodness of creation, the fine arts, nature, anything. And we actually spoil our appetite for real love. One example I was speaking about with several people was just this whole idea of we can spoil ourselves, we can spoil children by giving them too many things. And we spoil their desire because they don't have a chance to let their desire grow for the object so that they actually know that they want it. When we wait for what we desire, what happens? Two things can happen. One is, like, I want a pony, I want a pony. Daddy, give me a pony. And the father gives her a pony. And she goes, oh, that's great. And the next day she's like, oh, I don't want to feed that thing, right? You know, or she likes it for a little while, and then I don't want to have anything to do with that. It's too much work. But if she's given, in fact, this happened when we were young. I was 8, and I had horseback riding lessons. I said, Dad, I want a horse, I want a horse, I want a horse. And he said, okay, well, we'll think about it. And he made us wait 2 years, and then he bought us a horse. We had some land. And I loved that horse. And I loved riding. But I had been given the opportunity to develop and deepen the desire. It also could have gone the other way, that I would have just, if I didn't care after a while, that would have said that wasn't a desire that needed to be fulfilled, right? So we need to wait when we have desires to really deepen our capacity for that. Now I want to talk to you about affectivity and effectivity. Affectivity is this, I think I've been very evident to you, and it is this capacity to be moved by the emotions of love, desire, and joy. And effectivity is about action, doing things, producing things, reasoning through things, as totally different purposes, right? And they are complementary. And I want to give you, Dr. Tarua gave some examples that I want you just to imagine. And there's examples of this. First, consider the hand of a man who desires a woman. Now think of the hand of a man who desires to console. Next, think of the look of a girl who is flirting. And now, imagine the look of a mother towards her disabled child. In the first, in the person, you see the evidence of effectivity, right? Is that now my intention is to have something, someone. And in the second example, each example is that I want to receive and be open, and I am moved by the goodness of this person or what they need, right? And how they are feeling. So there's a big difference, but they're complementary. We want to be able to, there's a fruit when our effectivity exists in the service of our affectivity. The mind exists in the service of the heart. Okay. I want to give you a personal story as an example as of how this can manifest itself in daily life. When I was about 11 or 12, I grew up in a Catholic family, a very good family, and I began to really think about what the Eucharist was and grasp what I was doing when I went to communion. And I started getting a little grossed out, to be honest, because I thought, oh my goodness, we're eating Jesus' body and blood. And this is just sort of repugnant. And so I went to my dad and I told him this, and I said, I don't know that I can go to communion. It's just, I just don't know if I can do that. And my dad gave me this such a beautiful answer, which really tells you his own relationship with Christ, that he had contemplated this himself. But he also was respecting me and opening me up to God's love. And he said, he acknowledged the truth, and he said, yes, it is true that we are eating literally Jesus' body and blood. But isn't it beautiful that God knew that if we saw what we were eating, if we saw real his flesh and his blood, that we could never do it. And so he comes to us in a little piece of bread. And my father did two things. He affirmed me. He gave me a gift where I was at, right? because I could not hear anything else. He affirmed me that my feelings were normal for my age, and maybe even for other ages, that that was normal when you think about the reality of the Holy Eucharist. But he also spoke the truth, and then he opened me to how God affirms me. God affirms us, that God restrains his own love for the good of us so that we can have a relationship with him on our terms. Because he knows that we couldn't ever receive him that way. So here's this beautiful thing. And this is something that Dr. Trua said, and I may have already said this, but affectivity simultaneously brings peace and resolves difficulties. And this is what happened. I could have, if my father had said, or had been someone who had said, you know, you really shouldn't think like that, or, oh, you ought to be ashamed of yourself to think about that, you know? Well, I would have been afraid, I probably would have become scrupulous. You know, none of that happened. It all faded away. Everything was fine. And it was part of this growth in love for God, because my father loved me in that way, and he also showed God's love for me in this affirming, this eternally affirming way, right? That God effectively met me there. So there's many ways that I could give you examples, and I don't have time right now, of how Jesus affirmed people in the scriptures. So when we come to know God's love, you know, this God that, isn't this the God that we want to love us? Isn't the God that we long for? The God that loves us just as we are. When he met the woman, for example, caught in adultery, what did he immediately do? Well, you know, you really shouldn't have done that, and I can see where they want to stone you. I'll save you from that, but no, he didn't do that, right? Right? Sometimes that's what we do to people, right? Because we're like, I got to correct this. But what did Jesus do? He looked around, and of course, there's a story about this. There's a joke about this, but I won't tell the joke. You know the joke. But he looked around, and he said to her, he said, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Well, who of us would have thought that line, right? And it's like, okay, they're all like, okay, drop the stone. And he looks at her and he says, has anyone condemned you? No. And she's quaking in her boots. And he says, neither do I condemn you. And then he says, he intellectually affirms her. He is showing her her worth, that she is not defined by her sin, and he intellectually affirms her by telling the truth, by saying, go in peace and avoid this sin from now on. He didn't say that first, right? So he opened her up to her goodness, and then he brings her to how she is to live, right? His affectivity followed by his effectivity, okay? So this is very different than living in terms of how many of us do of on our willpower, pulling up our bootstraps, just powering through. It is more of an open and quiet way of living in which we are open to the goodness of things and people, where we are begin to be free to live more spontaneously and effortlessly and honestly and joyfully. And I'll leave you there with that until this afternoon. Thank you.